Hi, it's Jamie, Progressive number one, number two employee. Leave a message at the... Hey, Jamie, it's me, Jamie. This is your daily pep talk. I know it's been rough going ever since people found out about your a cappella group, Mad Harmony, but you will bounce back. I mean, you're the guy always helping people find coverage options with the Name Your Price tool. It should be you giving me the pep talk. Now get out there, hit that high note, and take Mad Harmony all the way to nationals this year! Sorry, this is pitchy.
Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Welcome to Creating a Family, talk about infertility and adoption. Today we're going to be talking about deciding to live child-free. I'm Dawn Davenport, the director of Creating a Family, the National Infertility and Adoption Education and Support Nonprofit. You can find out more about us at our website, creatingafamily.org. Hey, we primarily keep in touch with our audience through our weekly e-newsletter, and we would love to have you receiving that newsletter. We let you know about the latest developments in infertility as well as the new resources we add to our site each week. And who knows, maybe one of those resources is exactly what you need to be hearing or reading or viewing. We tell you about the upcoming week's blog and show topic, and you can also submit questions in advance for the show. To sign up for our weekly newsletter, go to any page of our website, creatingafamily.org, and look at the top right corner. This show is brought to you, underwritten by our corporate sponsor, Ferring Pharmaceutical. Ferring is pleased to offer their IVF Greenlight program, providing discounts of up to 50% on select IVF products. All cash-paying patients are eligible, and unlike other programs, there are no financial requirements. Get more information at ivfgreenlight.com. This show, as well as all the resources provided by Creating a Family, could not happen without the generous support from our gold sponsors, who believe in our mission of providing unbiased education and support to those struggling to create a family. Some of our wonderful gold sponsors include Manhattan Cryobank. They are dedicated to helping clients have healthy babies by analyzing a client's DNA in combination with the DNA of prospective sperm donors. That way, the patients have a safer list of potential donors. We also have RMA, our Reproductive Medicine Associates of New Jersey. They also go by RMA New Jersey. They are a recognized scientific and patient care leader in the field of infertility. With 10 offices and 21 physicians throughout New Jersey, RMA New Jersey maintains an IVF delivery rate well above the national average. In 1997, the first embryo adoption program in the world began, named Snowflake's Embryo Adoption Program. It was the brainchild of Nightlight Christian Adoptions. Now, more than 450 Snowflake babies have been born as a result of direct embryo donation through the Snowflakes program at Nightlight Adoption. The law offices of James Fletcher Thompson, a South Carolina firm committed to assisted reproductive law and adoption. They also have a gestational surrogacy matching program, and as well as providing legal services for independent surrogacy, egg donation, and embryo donation matters. And we have Fairfax Cryobank, a leader in sperm donation for over 25 years. They are dedicated to supplying updated, verified, and accurate medical and personal information on their donors. On today's show, we're going to be talking about the decision to live child-free. This year, I reread a book that I had read in the past by Sheridan Voysey, and the title of the book is Resurrection Year, Turning Broken Dreams into New Beginnings. I so enjoyed this book. It actually isn't necessarily specific to or only specific to coming to the end of an infertility journey. However, it was specifically written about that topic. It could apply to any lost dreams and how you create a new life. It was such a good book. And let's face it, infertility treatment is not always successful, and truthfully, neither is adoption. And sometimes adoption isn't the right option for a family, so they come down, or a couple, or a person. They come to have to make a decision of continuing in treatment, even though treatment is not working, or adopting, and they choose not to adopt. This show, we have our guests are Sheridan Voysey, the author of Resurrection Year, as well as Jen Gamper. She is an infertility therapist with RMA New Jersey, and she also has a private psychotherapy practice in Basking Ridge, New Jersey. This is a re-airing of a show that we did a couple of years ago. After I had reread the book, Resurrection Year, I wanted to bring you this show again because I really felt like it provided such hope and such support to those people who, for whom the dream of having a family may not happen. I hope you enjoy it. Welcome, Sheraton and Jen, to Creating a Family. I'm so glad to have you here.
Sheraton,
I wanted... Good. I wanted to begin with you. I want to tell you how much I loved your book. I really enjoyed it. You did a really good job of capturing the anguish of infertility and the questions that this struggle can often leave with us. It forced you to question your faith and to search for spiritual answers, and it was honest, and I truly appreciated it. And it was also, it's hard to say this, it was an enjoyable book, even though it was about a very painful subject. I thoroughly enjoyed it, which, quite frankly, I didn't expect to enjoy, but I did. So thank you.
Oh, well, that's very high praise indeed coming from you, Dawn. Thank you very much. It is a tough book, particularly that first chapter is really tough to get through. And most people will say that they're in tears by the end of the first chapter. But hopefully there is a note of hope that comes from, chapter 2, chapter 3 onwards.
It is. It ultimately is a very hopeful book, which I'm going to save some of this because I'm going to blog. I'm going to do a review of the book tomorrow on my blog, which I don't often do, but I am going to tomorrow. And I did feel like it was a very hopeful book, which is it's almost a contradiction in terms when we think about not the title, but the subject matter. On a side note, it did make me want to take up journaling, but I doubt very seriously that that will actually happen.
Oh, you should. You should. One of the best tools in the world for processing your thoughts and coming to resolve on things.
I hear you. And I've done it at times in my life, but it only tends to be at times when I'm really wrestling with something, so it tends to be a very one-sided picture of my life. And anyway, that's a whole nother, that's a whole nother story. I want to start with your infertility story, so to speak, or your infertility bona fides. I've already mentioned in an introduction that you and your wife, Maren, struggled for 10 years. Can you take us through a little bit of what you went through? You didn't immediately jump into IVF, but go ahead and just kind of take us through the crib note version, not the long and painful, but not the long version.
Yes. Well, like many couples, I can remember the day when we made the decision to start a family. It was a day in the year 2000, and Maren walked into the kitchen and she said, "Honey, I think it's time." And I didn't quite get onto what she was talking about at first, but of course she meant it's time to start a family, and it was time. And from that point on, like every couple, every 28 days, you're looking for signs of success. And unfortunately, the months rolled on and on and on, and we had no signs of success. We started going and get some tests done, and the initial tests showed that there was a problem on both of our sides. I mean, a little bit of PCOS for Maren, but predominantly the problem was on my side with an exceptionally low sperm count. And from that point on, apart from surrogacy, I think we pretty much tried it. We tried special diets. We tried special supplements. We tried healing prayer. You mentioned that we're people of faith. That was an important thing for us. We tried our first round of in vitro fertilization in 2006. We then weren't successful with that. We then decided to look into adoption in the Australian system in 2008, went through the whole 8-month, 9-month assessment process. And then we were told, "Look, you're a very attractive couple. Just wait for the phone call until you're placed with a child." And we went through local adoption and we waited for the phone call. Well, long story short, nearly 2 years later, the phone call hadn't come. By that stage, Maren, my wife, was in a particularly bad way because she'd been waiting for so many years already. So we went and tried another series of rounds of IVF, the last one of which, when we had our final embryo transferred, we had been told that we were given some good news, that we had been successful. And then we had a phone call on Christmas Eve, of all days, telling us, no, they'd gotten it wrong. It had all been a mirage. And that is when basically our 10-year dream came to an end.
In your case, your infertility was primarily male factor. Did you consider donor sperm?
No, we didn't. And that's a good question. I wrestled in particular with the whole ethics of this. And again, I'm coming at it from a person of faith. And so I was very keen to try and work out, you know, when does life begin? When does it not? For some of your listeners, that won't be such an issue, but for some of it will. And it was a bit of an issue.
For some, it will.
Aaron,
I mean, there are definitely people in our listening audience and in our online support group that do wrestle with that. So yes, it actually,
right.
Some do and some don't.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it took me 2 years to try and, you know, become comfortable with the whole issue of IVF. I don't think too many people would take that long. I think I was just a stickler for detail in many ways. But I think we decided not to use either donor sperm or surrogacy because we wanted to, in every way possible, we wanted to make this still a product of Meron and me, so that there wasn't a third party that actually came into it. And that's what we felt was honoring our faith. That's what we felt was honoring the ethical aspects of it that we had laid down for ourselves.
And at the end, you describe your when you get the call on December 24th, Christmas Eve, and you had already made the decision prior to that cycle that would be your last cycle of IVF. And you describe the next part of the book describes your move to ultimately to acceptance. What was the first steps towards making the decision that you already had made the decision that this would be it. And what was the first step towards acceptance for you and for Meron when after you licked your wounds from that very heartbreaking realization that, in fact, she was not pregnant?
Yeah. Yeah, well, the very first step was, of course, the decision. So we had already decided that the final embryo was going to be the final embryo, and that's why when we had been given good news about the final embryo, it was so much so, you know, the cuts stung even more when we found out that it had been a mirage in the end, that we weren't actually pregnant from that. So we had already come to the decision that we could not go on anymore. Anybody who has been in this situation knows that whole cycle of expectation and disappointment every single month, expectation and disappointment. And it happens, of course, when you're waiting for adoption, you're waiting for the phone call every day, every week. Is the phone call going to come this week or next month? And after 10 years of that expectation, disappointment cycle, we were just basically wrung out. And so we had made the decision that this would be our final embryo. We had to move on with our lives. So I guess the first step was really making that decision, and that was a difficult decision. But when we then had the phone call on Christmas Eve to say, no, you're not pregnant, it hurt, and there were for 2 or 3 days there that we just simply went to ground. We didn't take any phone calls. We didn't talk to anybody. But actually, after that, we started to feel that we had been freed, released in some way, because now the ordeal was over. The decision had been made. Now we can move on with our lives. So I guess there was, maybe 2 or 3 steps. The first step was making the decision. The second step was putting the decision into action. And then the third step was a certain grieving process. And I think that was an important thing, that we had to grieve what was lost. And after that came the ability to start again.
Sheraton, can I ask you a question from a therapist perspective? I'm curious, for you, did you think you were sort of leading the way in making the decision to stop treatment, or was Meron, or how did that work for the two of you?
Yeah, good question. Between the two of us, Meron was the one who really, really wanted children. I was going to be happy either way. I think I would have made a pretty good dad, but I wasn't to be a dad. But I would have probably finished this journey a lot earlier. But Meron really, really wanted to try every single avenue. And so when it came to making the decision at the end, it was one that I was more than happy to go along with because, I would have finished the journey earlier on. So it's something we definitely made together as a couple. And we worked very hard at, you know, being on the same page the whole time. But that required sacrifice from both of us at different parts of the journey.
That's one of the leading things is the research is showing that men actually are more often willing to end treatment prior to their partners, where women are more willing to try new treatments and keep going. And so that's why I was curious with that question, because I know that a lot of couples do struggle with that, one being willing to stop sooner than the other and the other one to continue to try.
You know, and I wanted to talk about that too, because you're exactly, we see that, I mean, you're speaking of research, which I love, but I also obviously see that very anecdotally in our listening audience as well as our support group. I wouldn't say universally, but really pretty darn close to universally. Mm-hmm. How does that, and Jen, I'm directing this question to you, how does that disparity between desires play out for different couples, because it's a real issue when one of the male is just tired of the whole process and it's so draining, and the other one is not. How does that in something this important? How does that play out between the couples in your practice? What you see?
Yeah, what I find is that there's a lot of fear for the relationship because they really need to express what both of them are feeling. And so what I do find is counseling is really important at this point, is to sort of have a third party to sit down with you so that you feel safe, so that you can express those concerns. So for men, a lot of them will say, you know, I see my wife on this mission. I feel really bad being the one to say, you know, where do we draw the line and how do we stop and how much further do we want to try? And so I think that's where I say that as a couple, you really have to sit down and have an open and frank conversation about where you're both at, sort of coming up with a plan together. The plan might change along the journey. You might find that you might stop sooner or you might want to try one more cycle, but I think that you have to be open with each other to really express those fears and those concerns over the relationship, and I think that's where a therapist comes in. I really believe that counseling or even support groups really help patients to be able to say to each other how they're really feeling throughout this process.
I'm a big believer in support groups, both in person and online. I have just seen, you know, it's just knowing that you're not alone. Sheraton, in your case, it was predominantly male factor. Did that make it easier or harder, both for you and for Marin, to reach the point of willingness to let this dream go?
I don't know whether it made it easier because it was particularly on my side as opposed to Marin's. I think the journey would have been, If the journey had continued on to the same degree of time, had the problem been on Marin's side, I think the emotional aspects would still be the same. As a guy, I personally wrestled with guilt. I just felt, and you would have got this out of the book, Dawn, because I just felt that it was my problem and it was my reason. I was the reason why my wife could not have what she so desperately wanted. And that's where it particularly hit me. And Marin was so good. Marin was speaking about our experience at a retreat one day, and somebody said, "Are you angry with Sheraton?" And Marin said, "No, I'm not. It's not his fault. He didn't choose this. He didn't decide that he didn't want children, and somehow that, you know, it wasn't his fault at all." And yet, of course, that can be a natural response for many women, is that they're kind of angry at their husband. I'm really grateful that Marin wasn't angry. She got angry at the situation, but she never got angry at me, which I'm really grateful for.
Jen, do you find that anger is reflected on either? If one of the partners is the cause, or the primary cause, male or female, do you find that anger is gets in the way of resolution?
I wouldn't say with every couple, but it's interesting. I'm sitting here shaking my head as Sheraton talks because I absolutely think what he's saying is so valid for women also. I have so many patients that come in and sit with me, and for women who might need egg donation or it might be an issue for them, are saying the same thing. I feel bad that I can't provide my spouse with this child that we've envisioned and this dream that we've always had. I feel guilty. I feel fear that he or she is angry at me. So sort of all of those feelings, I think, come and go for many patients. I think there is a little bit of an anger for some, not for everybody, an anger that we're sort of being faced with this, but also a sadness. I think that anger sort of at some point does turn into a sadness in the mourning process. And if you study mourning, you know that that sort of ebbs and flows. At some points there could be an anger there. Sometimes there's a sadness. Sometimes there's a bargaining. I mean, I think those are sort of all of the phases that patients have to go through with the mourning of, sort of changing this plan that they had in their mind of having a family and a child might not be that plan anymore. And so there are certainly some patients that are angrier than others, and that's why I say this couples counseling and working through it and talking about these fears and talking about these feelings are important to be able to express that to each other so that you can make a new plan to move forward and come up with what that might be.
Yeah.
And so I think, you know, man or woman, I think men and women both experience exactly what you're talking about.
What I see more often just in our audience, and it could be because it's not acceptable for people to really, you know, express their anger, although people feel pretty comfortable in our group to express pretty much anything. But I see less anger towards a spouse and more, as what Sheridan just described, anger at the situation and at the unfairness of the whole thing. Although sometimes I suppose it's anger at the spouse if you are on different pages as to what to do about it, but not anger at them because of their infertility.
I agree with you. I think there's definitely that anger of you might want to stop now, but I might want to keep on going. And I think that's where the anger comes in, is that we're not on the same page here. We're both sort of dealing with it in a different way, and I'm ready to continue to try that next IVF cycle or the egg donation, and you might not be ready. And I think that's where the anger comes in, is not being able to express where do we draw the line and where are we both together in agreement, you know, what's the next step.
And Jen, you'd be able to say that, no, the link between anger and frustration is certainly there as well. And certainly we do have that. And I talked about, you know, the fact that it took me a couple of years to work out the ethics of IVF. That was because for some stage, I actually put the whole problem down for a bit and said, I don't want to deal with this anymore. And that's when actually Meryn did get very frustrated with me, because she said, look, my whole life is on hold until you work out your ethical position on this. So please get on and do it. So there was certainly frustration in there, but I'm thankful that it wasn't kind of full-blown anger. But I'm really glad that we're actually talking about this, the impact that infertility has on a couple, because we did sit in front of a IVF counselor at one stage who, you know, told us, look, you know, IVF is going to bring a lot of pressure into your marriage, and, you know, you're going to have to deal with that. And we thought initially she was just talking about the impact of the drugs on the woman's hormonal cycle and et cetera. And she said, well, no, I'm talking about the decision-making. And with that, Meryn made the comment. She said, Sheridan and I have already made the decision that our marriage is more important than having a family, having a child, and if it gets in the way of our marriage, we're going to stop. And at that point, the IVF counselor literally slumped in her chair, and she said, I'm so glad to hear you say that, because just yesterday, a lady and a husband sitting in the very same chairs that you're sitting in now, the lady said in front of her husband to me, if this IVF doesn't work, our marriage is over. And I think just don't let two dreams die. I think that's my encouragement to folks. You know, the couple have got to stay strong together, and we all know just how much pressure can come into a marriage as a result of infertility.
I think that's important. What you're saying is that I think a lot of people come in and you start to lose sight of what brought you here, and you together as a couple working on this ultimate goal together. And I think that you do start to become sort of, I had a patient that once said to me, I feel like I'm on this treadmill that I can't get off. I'm just going and going and going and going. And I thought that was a great example, saying, you know, I can't stop off that treadmill to help make a decision with my partner about what or not we should stop or continue going. I just feel like I'm on this mission. And so I do think you're right. As a couple, you sort of have to define what it is that we want to do. How far do we want to go? We're in this together as a couple. And I do sometimes see that with some people. When you come in, you start to lose track and lose sight of what it is that you're in this together as a unit. And so, yeah, I think that was amazing that you both came to that conclusion from the very beginning. So as a therapist, I can understand when she slumped over in her chair to say, wow, that was a very healthy way of looking at it from the beginning.
Jen, what do you see in Sheridan's case? It seems clear that this struggle actually has strengthened their marriage. But what do you see, or have you read statistics or research that would say whether that is, does infertility tend to break up and weaken marriages, or does it tend to strengthen them? Is there any type of research that would point one way or the other?
There was some interesting research done a while ago that did show that marriages are strengthened from infertility, but then again, there was also some research that had said that it does not, that there's a higher divorce rate. So I think that's still out there right now. I think there needs to be some better research done on that. I do find with some couples, it does make or break them. I think that the struggle of infertility forces you to really talk about things that maybe you had not ever talked about in your life, to really struggle with emotions that a lot of patients have never experienced before until they became, going through infertility treatment. So I think that, again, the biggest thing is to be open and to be honest with each other and to express those concerns, those feelings from the very beginning. I think that there are a lot of relationships that become much stronger. It forces them to talk about some things that they had never thought that they would be faced with. I do see now, also, there are some patients that have been struggling for years and years and years, and they realize that it isn't just about having a child. It's about their relationship. And then I've seen the opposite, where I've seen patients coming in where they've only been together as a couple maybe for a few months and now are faced with infertility. And so now they're still in sort of that honeymoon phase of their relationship. They're still trying to work as a couple in general about things in life, and now we're throwing them with infertility treatment and all sorts of other stuff. So, I think that's something that we really have to do some more research on in general and look at divorce rates in general across the board versus divorce rates of patients going through fertility treatment.
When you talked about the sometimes it's the first time people have ever faced something like this, it reminds me, I interviewed Nia Valdaros, my Big Fat Greek Wedding, the actress who both wrote it. Anyway, and she had a book that I interviewed her. The book was, I think, Instant Mom. And I don't remember the exact, but I think it was something like 12 cycles of IVF. I'm not 100%. You can, for the audience, you can go back onto our radio page or just type in Nia Valdaros in our search, and you'll find that, and you can listen. But she said that she had never faced not being able, that her will could not overcome something, and that all of her life, if she had worked hard at something and really put her mind to it, she succeeded. And that she just, there wasn't, in her worldview, there was nothing, including infertility, that she wouldn't be able to succeed. So she just kept plugging away. It was just a matter of will over infertility. And ultimately, infertility won, and she talked about how unbelievably devastating that was, you know, for her on every level, because it shook her worldview. And I think that is often the case for people.
Absolutely. I think I've had many patients that have come and said, you know, I've worked really hard. I've gotten into the college I wanted to go to. I worked really hard. I got the degree that I wanted. I worked really hard and went, got all my resumes done and got the job I wanted. You know, I finally met the person I wanted to spend the rest of my life with and have a family with. So all of these things they've ever worked really hard to get, they wanted. And now the one thing that you, no matter how hard you work, no matter what we tell you to do, no matter acupuncture, no matter, gluten-free eating, no matter all of these diets that are out there, no matter what I try, I can't be successful. And so it's an absolute loss of control for many of these patients. And so that's one of the things when you talk about sort of this plan, and how far do I want to go and sort of, do we want to try IVF, do we not? And so I think that that's one of that's a little bit of a piece that patients can feel is a little bit of control by sitting down and saying as a couple, okay, well, what do we want to do? Where do we want to go from here? How much are we willing to try? Am I comfortable with IVF? Do we want to do something holistic first? And I think that gives them a little bit of control over sort of a plan of where they're going to go from here. But I think absolutely what she was saying is that many, many patients experience that. This is the one thing I really, really long for, and I can't get.
You know, I'm really glad you brought up the concept of control, because I mean, infertility is many things, and of course, different things to different people, but almost universally, it is a feeling of lack of control. Sheridan, when you and Marin made the decision, okay, this is it, did in some way your move to acceptance, was that aided by the fact that you were finally back in control? Did the issue of getting back in control of your lives play into an ease of, not that it was easy, but that making it easier for you to move forward in living child-free?
I think that's a really good point, because we felt like our lives had just been put on hold for 10 years. Because either we were doing IVF and therefore you have to be very close to the IVF clinic, or When it came to waiting for adoption for those couple of years with the Australian system, and we were in New South Wales, and with the New South Wales system, the idea was, you know, don't leave the state, because it could be tomorrow that you get the phone call, or if you're going to leave the state, you know, let us know. And because the phone call could come and you could really have to quickly rush off and jump onto a plane and go and collect your child or start the handover process that could be a few days long. And so there was always that sense that our lives are on hold, and I think there certainly is a control issue there. And I think in a healthy way, we need a certain degree of agency over our lives. So definitely that was something there for us. It wasn't so much for us that we'd been these great successes in every other area of our life, and then suddenly we couldn't have control over this aspect of it. That wasn't quite the same for us, but certainly once we were able to move over after that Christmas Eve phone call and actually kind of just say, okay, that's it, we're moving on with our lives, there was a certain sense of freedom and being able to take control of our lives again.
Well, you described... No, go ahead, Jen.
Well, I was just saying, listening to you talk, I think one of the things about living child-free is that a lot of people don't look at it as an equal option. They sort of look at it, some patients, as like a defeat. So listening to what Sheridan was saying about, like, we finally made this choice. We finally came to terms with it and made this choice. And it sounded almost as if you had this, like, weight lifted off of your shoulders that now you can continue on.
Yeah, it certainly did. In fact, Maren would say that as devastating as that phone call was on Christmas Eve, there was, paradoxically, there was almost a sense of relief in it, because now the journey was over, because we'd already made the decision before then that this was it. And so when the phone call came, it was shocking. I mean, when she actually got the phone call from the clinic, she walked into our room and she curled up in a fetal position onto our bed. I mean, that's how traumatic it was. And yet she would say, there was something after that initial shock. After that, there was a freedom in it, because finally, now we can move on with our lives.
You know, I can definitely see that. But there was something that I thought was so important that I, very shortly thereafter, and I don't remember the sequence, she turned to you and she said, I need a new beginning. We need to treat this as a new beginning. And describe what it was. And I should point out that at this point, you were a very successful radio broadcaster. I don't think I included that in your introduction, and I meant to. You were a radio broadcaster and a published author in Australia, very successful. And I think Maren was successful in her career as a medical researcher. And so she turned to you and she wanted a new beginning. What did that look like for you two?
Well, we were sitting by the Sydney Harbour talking about the future one day, and she said, the thought of our lives just continuing on as normal, if we're not going to have a family, is just too depressing for me to think about. And I put my arm around her, you know, husband to the rescue kind of thing, and I said, well, you know, what would you like, love? What would be a nice kind of consolation prize for you? And that's when Maren said, you know, the only other thing that I've ever wanted to do with my life, apart from become a mother, is to live and work overseas. So next year, and she was talking about 2011, next year, can we move overseas? And as you've just said, Dawn, things were going very well for me in Australia. And that was a hard conversation to have, because I knew it was coming. I knew that was the only other dream that she really had for her life. But it came to fruition on that particular day that this is what I really want to do. And, you know, there's a biblical proverb that talks about hope deferred makes the heart sick, but a dream fulfilled is a tree of life. And we had certainly experienced the first part of that proverb. Hope deferred does make the heart sick. And I guess it was time then for Maren to have a dream fulfilled to help her get that tree of life that she so desperately needed, because she was in a really bad state. I mean, I had held her crying most nights for the previous couple of months before that phone call on Christmas Eve, and she needed a new beginning. And so that's basically where the new beginning kind of the idea started from, and that's also the cost that was going to be in providing that new beginning for Maren.
And you did in fact take off and move abroad and really reinvented your life. In this case, it was in England, correct?
Yeah, it was. Long story short, the whole story is in Resurrection Year, but Maren was offered a job at Oxford University, which we saw as kind of a sign to move to the UK. You don't get a job at a university like Oxford University very often. And so we took that as an opportunity to move over to the UK. And, again, I want to make it really, really clear that a new job or a new opportunity or even moving countries is no replacement for a child at all. But it certainly was that new beginning, that new start, that dream fulfilled, if you like, that helped to revive Maren's heart and helped us start again. And I think it's just really important to think through a consolation prize, not a defeat prize, not an also-ran prize, but a consolation prize. You know, what is there a secondary dream that you may now have free hands and a free life to be able to go and pursue? You can think about the positive aspects of being childless. I mean, there are a lot of positives. You have more freedom. You've got more disposable income. You've got more time to yourself. Again, anybody who's listening to this will say, yes, but I'd get rid of all of that if I could just have a child, and that's true. But there's no doubt an opportunity there when you don't have children to then utilize your status and maybe be able to travel or maybe do something that you otherwise couldn't do.
I wanted to hear your thoughts on that moving to acceptance through the idea of a dream, looking for the next dream fulfilled. Talk to us about that, what you think.
Yeah, I think it's important to make a new life plan, which might not involve having a child, and that, again, might be difficult. But what Sheraton was saying, one of the points I was also thinking of is that, you know, a lot of patients will say, I don't know if I'm ready for that. So I think it's okay to sort of come up with a trial plan in a way. So maybe create a life of living child-free and seeing how that would be. Maybe moving to England, to Oxford, maybe taking on a new job. There are plenty of people that will do that and say, you know what? This is great. We have this great life. We can travel now. We can do all of these things. And there certainly are patients who I've said, you know, come up with this trial plan and see how it would feel for you. And they might come back. They might say, you know what, we really thought it through. We've taken the last 2 years and we've decided, you know what, we want to try something different. And maybe that isn't the plan that we really felt was appropriate for us. But I think, you know, it certainly does not hurt to sort of try it on and see how it feels for you. I think a lot of patients are very scared to come up with something so definitive, to come up with a final answer, come up with this final decision. And so I always say to patients, to help you sort of with this mourning process and coming up with this new life plan, try it on for size and see if it does fit for you and see if it is something that you feel comfortable with. Because it might not be for everybody, but certainly a lot of patients along the way will find their niche and will find that thing that does fulfill them and makes them happy in life and this new plan that they sort of had not initially envisioned.
What happens in your experience, Jen? Well, let me back up. With Sheraton and Maren, they both knew that the next plan would be living child-free. But in other couples I see, one of them, would be the plan of choice to move child-free. But to others, it would be to reinvest themselves in adoption, and more likely it would be to open themselves up to different forms of adoption, either adopting a slightly older child from foster care or abroad, or opening up their acceptance of what risk factors they can accept, or donor embryo, donor egg, or even surrogacy, depending on their financial wherewithal. What about when couples don't agree on what the next step might be, child-free or another step? And you talked about it being the treadmill. I think of infertility often as an escalator because it seems like it's the next step up that's always coming, and it's never-ending because there's always something else you can try. So what happens when couples don't agree on that?
So what I always say to couples is I say, let's sit down and talk about it. And I think it certainly does not hurt to do the research and to understand more. I think for a lot of people, there is a fear of what is egg donation going to mean? How am I going to feel? What is embryo adoption or embryo donation going to feel like? What is child-free living going to feel like? And so I always say it doesn't mean you have to make a decision, but I think it's important to go on to different websites, to go to different support groups, to go to different lectures, to learn about all of these different areas, and to see. As you sit there, you might be surprised that something that you had never been open to, maybe adoption, didn't feel right for you or didn't feel comfortable with you, but sitting and listening to parents who have adopted or children who have been adopted might make you look at it from a different perspective. And so that's what I always encourage. I always say, do your research, go to some of these lectures, go onto some of these podcasts, and listen to the different perspectives that are out there to really educate yourself what your options are, because there are many and they're vast and they can be overwhelming. And then I always say to patients, and then let's sit down and revisit. How did you feel when you listened to adoption? Let's talk about it from both of your perspectives. How did you feel when you talked about and learned about embryo donation? Both. And I think that that's important to really sort of hear all of these various options. And they might get onto the same page and they might not. And then again, that's where the counseling and the support groups come in, is to really help them process their feelings about each of these areas.
One of the things that is, in fact, we've recently been talking about it in our support group, and I've been blogging, I blogged on it, and it's the, well, when you say you stop trying, what does that really mean? And I guess my question to you, Sharon, would be this. When you and Maren said, okay, this is it, you know, we're not going to do any more IVF, did that stop your hoping and dreaming and holding your breath at the end of the 28-day cycle that a pregnancy would occur? And how long did it take to reach the point that you weren't hoping and secretly praying and timing your timing sex to make sure it's happening during the fertile times and things like that?
Yeah, such a good question, because everything that you've, you know, opened up here for us, Dawn, in the last few minutes is just something that we continually hear from other couples as well. And in the language of broken dreams, which is, of course, the language that has come out of the book, what people will say to me is, when do you know it's time to let a dream die? So all these are just such important areas, and it's just so good that Jen is sitting down with her clients and having these conversations and coming up with trial plans and working out all these kinds of different options. It's just so huge. When we made that decision to stop, remember that it came after 10 years of trying. So I would hate to, you know, for maybe somebody who's just gone through 2 or 3 months of infertility listening to us and saying, oh, well, maybe I need to, you know, think about bringing the journey to an end. It was 10 years for us. So we really had given it a good go. So when we did make the decision and we did decide to move on, we made that a firm decision that from this point on, we're not going back. And we're not going to entertain possibilities. We're not going to kind of keep the option alive in the back of our minds. I think that's the really important thing. It was a firm decision. Now, that doesn't mean that there have been
times afterwards. I was just going to say, now let's talk specifics here.
Yeah.
How firm is firm?
Yeah. Well, it is firm, but that doesn't mean that the issue hasn't arose. So I think probably about... we were here in the UK, maybe about 8 months later, we met this lovely couple at church, and we found out that, you know, in their experience of adoption here in the UK, they had been placed with a child within about 4 or 5 weeks, you know, we had waited for 2 years after the assessment process, so it's been nearly 3 years all up, And, you know, so that raised the question, well, is it easier to adopt in the UK than it is in Australia? So what happened is that Maren and I both individually, she started wondering about the idea. I asked a friend of mine who was championing a big kind of fostering and adoption movement over here called Home for Good. His name is Krish Gandhara. I spoke to Krish and said, look, what is the process? Now, it was a kind of thing where we were looking into it, but we weren't actually letting our heart go down that road, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
And there came another conversation between Maren and me where I guess you could say with the 10 years looking and trying everything to try and start a family the first time, I guess you could say that maybe I was the one who was making quite a few of the sacrifices and the concessions and saying, okay, I don't really want to do this, but I want to do this for you and I want to do this for the possibility of getting a child. There came a time after that conversation that we had when Maren and I said, you know, well, what about it? And I actually said to her, you know what, I can't face going through all of that again, so I think I'm going to have to say that I just can't do this. And Maren said, okay, I accept that. So it's a firm decision. There was a time when we then started to re-entertain the idea, but it was a case of then going back and saying, no, this is a firm decision. We're continuing to move on. I think the real problem is when people leave it as an option in the back of their minds and they haven't actually properly closed the door on it, because then they can't actually grieve. And we see more people that are kind of more held back by that they haven't grieved and actually moved on with their lives than any kind of problem of later on down the track saying, oh, maybe there's a possibility now.
I think that is such a good point. There was one of our, in our support group, a woman, and this is what the blog was about, had emailed me that she and her husband had decided that they didn't want, that it was over. And they thought it, but every, she said she couldn't, it was almost she couldn't help herself, knowing when she was ovulating and trying to make certain that they made love during that time, and knowing at the end of the month, getting her hopes up, even though she shouldn't. And she said that continual cycle. And she made the decision to have her tubes tied. She said, I don't seem to be able to do it on my own, just to put it totally to bed. And, but I need to. I need that. I need to let this dream die so that I can grieve and get on with the next step, that type of thing. And that, it was an interesting, and I have to admit, most of the people that as we discussed this in the comments to the blog and in the support group, I think few people thought that they would have the guts to actually tie their tubes, but that they certainly appreciated her need for finality. Jen, do you see this? Sheraton brought it up in the adoption context, which is, I could see that happening as well. But more often, it's the monthly grind of, oh, I'm ovulating, so we need to make love. Oh, okay, and then maybe could it be? Even though it's not in the forefront, it's in your mind.
There are all of these. I always call them the what ifs. What if it did work this month? Or what if I tried this? Or what if? So I think that if the patients are coming in and they're still having a lot of what ifs, what if I do this, what if I do that, they might not be ready to make that final decision. But if you're down to a minimal what if, and I think that it's okay to be healthy. I mean, I think that even patients who will say, you know what, we've decided that we are not going to move forward with any more treatment and we're going to move on with our lives and do things, I think it's still at some point, like Sheraton was saying, it's still at one point you had this little bit of what if, is what I call it. You know, what if it did work for an adoption in England? Does it mean that the decision that you've made to move forward and live child-free is a bad decision and isn't going to work for you? But I think it's only natural in life for us to have those. I wonder what would have happened if we did this, or I wonder if we had stayed in Australia, or what. You know, I think that life in general, we always have those sort of moments. So that's why I say to patients, it depends. If those what-ifs are all-consuming and you can't stop thinking about it and you keep thinking, if I don't try that next IVF cycle, I'm always going to be wondering if I hadn't, what would have happened, then I say maybe now is not the time for you to make this decision to not move forward or to move forward with adoption. So I always call it like minimal. If you have minimal what-ifs, if you have a point where, you know, there's more reasons to say that now is the time to stop than there are more reasons for me to consider moving forward, then you sort of know. But I agree that every patient is sort of different, and every couple gets to a place at a different point. And so I think it's very individualized.
Jen, can I just jump in with a question?
Go ahead, Sheraton.
Can I just jump in with a question for Jen? You know, in both of the stories that we just talked about, both mine and Merrin's, and then also the story that Dawn talked about with the lady who had her tubes tied, there was kind of a marker that was kind of, you know, there was a line drawn in the sand. And for Merrin and me, it was actually leaving our jobs, leaving our country, moving overseas, starting again. For that lady, it was actually having her tubes tied. Is there a sense in which there is a value for some sort of psychological or some sort of spiritual marker where you actually go and do something to mark the end of the former life and kind of the beginning of the new life?
Sure. I think for everybody, it comes at a different point, and some people might be quitting the job, but I think it's sort of sitting down and defining what a family is for us at this point. And maybe in the beginning, it was originally thinking of, you know, the 2.5 kids and the dog running around, but now maybe family is going to be defined differently. Maybe our family is going to consist of our friends. It's going to be the two of us. It's going to be traveling the world and traveling with my niece and nephew. So I sort of think it's sort of redefining this idea of what we want for ourselves and where we see ourselves in the future. And I think everybody is that marker, that line is different. I've certainly had plenty of patients that have quit their jobs and have moved or have said, you know what, we've always wanted to travel the world for the next year. And so let's do that now. Let's take that as an opportunity. But I think I always say to patients, okay, sit down and define, if you fast forward 10 years from now, how do you sort of want to define what your family will look like? And it might be the two of us traveling. And it might be, no, you know what, I still envision myself with children, and we both still envision ourselves with children. And so it might be going through foster care and having older children. But sort of sitting down and sort of redefining how we sort of envision what our family would be like. And to me, family is defined all different ways nowadays. I don't think it might be you and Marin, your family. The two of you are your family. It might be five children. It might be a dog. It might be your nieces and nephews who are over every weekend. It might be a group of friends that you've created for wherever you live now that seems like more family to you than maybe a genetic connection. So I think it's sort of defining that and figuring out, okay, what is it for us? And then going from there and then saying, okay, now this is where we're going to draw the line, or this is what we feel comfortable with, or.
Yeah, you know, that was certainly our experience.
Yeah, in Sheridan's case, they never had success. They did have the, as Sheridan called it, the mirage of one mm-hmm. pregnancy, the very last embryo transfer. But they've never had success. But other people are either having repeated miscarriages, so they are getting pregnant, or they're producing what they're hearing all the time, where, oh, these embryos are great. So it's almost as if they're constantly being teased with the possibility of success just around the corner, or people who have no, that there's no medical reason that has been found, unexplained infertility. So they're hearing that, you know, we don't know why you're not getting, you know, you should be able to get pregnant. Is it, in your experience, Jen, is it easier for people who have not had success to accept, in Sheraton's language, that it's time now to let the dream die, versus the people who are constantly experiencing almost success?
Yeah, I have to agree with you. I do think that there are plenty of patients that come in and have heard maybe from one doctor or another or somebody else that, you know, we just don't know why it's not working. And I think that's harder. They don't have any sense of closure. They mm-hmm. do fall into that category. Well, maybe if we go somewhere else, they can create a better embryo. Or maybe if we do this or that. So I do find, yes, the patients that come in and say, sorry, you know, your uterus just cannot sustain a pregnancy. Or in Sheridan and Marion's case, after 10 years, sorry, it's, you know, you are not pregnant. There's just no other way. There's no other options. I do find that those patients sort of seem to be able to close the door and make a decision to move forward in another way a little easier. It's the patients, like you said, that are on their fourth miscarriage and they say, well, everything looks great. We just don't know what it is. You know, those are the patients. Yeah, it's a lot harder to sort of take a step back and decide, okay, we're not going to try when there's no definitive answer. And I think that sort of comes into this whole control aspect of infertility, is that there's no control. It's not an exact science. We can't tell you exactly what's going to happen on what day and that it's definitely going to work. There's no exact. And so I think that's the difficult thing, is these patients who feel like they're lingering, they're sort of standing there waiting because no one can really tell them for sure what it is. And that's mm-hmm. frustrating. Yeah, no, very frustrating.
Yeah, it's almost like living. I blogged on it and called it the purgatory of unexplained infertility, because you're neither mm-hmm. here nor there. You are. It feels as if you are stuck. Sheridan, mm-hmm. explain your concept of the resurrection year. It's the title of the book, and it's crucial to your acceptance and your peace with the decisions you've made. So what is a resurrection year?
Yeah. I would love to take credit for the phrase. It's such a beautiful phrase, but it's actually an author friend of mine, Adrian Plass, who gave it to me, and he was just listening to our story. Actually, before the phone call on Christmas Eve, he's an author, and I had him on my show in Australia, and we were talking off air, and we'd become kind of friends over the years. And he said, after what you've told me about that you've gone through, it sounds like, you know, you've kind of gone through, using Easter language, if you like, you've gone through the crucifixion, and, you know, maybe soon you're going to come to Easter Saturday where it's all dark and quiet, nobody knows what's happening. Wouldn't it be wonderful if next year was your resurrection year? And I just took that phrase home to Marin, and she burst into tears when she heard it, and she said, that's exactly what I want. I want a resurrection year. And so, you know, there was no predefined definition as to what a resurrection year was. So, you know, we thought we would make one. And basically, it was our year of starting again. And we actually made it a kind of a literal 12 months on the calendar. Now, we didn't include the kind of packing up Australia and leaving, because that took 2 or 3 months out of the resurrection year. So, you know, it was as soon as we stepped on that plane and left on our little journey to ultimately arrive in Oxford, that was our resurrection year. And so we basically had 12 months. And when I look back at it, we didn't actually have any plan for it, apart from the fact that this was a year where Meryn was going to get her secondary dream, her consolation prize, her other dream to come true. It would be a year of kind of starting again. But when I look back on it, it had four key elements, and I can run those through for you if you like, Dawn.
I would love for you to.
Yeah, okay. Well, the first one was rest. We actually had some time away, and we just had a time of rest. Now, anybody who has been through a broken dream knows that they're probably just exhausted because they've tried to pursue it so much. And so we had a bit of a holiday in Europe. We went to Rome. We went to Switzerland and had a bit of time there. And we kind of just did all of that, just had a holiday, had a break, and started to do some things that we really enjoyed. So number one was rest. Number two was recreation. The literal meaning of the word recreation means to be recreated. So what are the hobbies and the things that you love to do, which you probably haven't done for a while because you put them on hold while you pursued the child thing, what can you take up again, the things that renew you, recreate you? So it was hobbies. For me, it was photography. For Meryn, it was just kind of lazy afternoons, you know, reading a novel, those kinds of things. So there was an opportunity to have just a little bit more recreation in life. So rest, recreation. The third one was renewal. There is, as we've already talked about before, when you go through something like this, you start to have your worldview rocked. You realize you're not as in control of the world as you thought you were. For us as committed Christians, there were questions about God and whether God was still good. Why did God not answer our prayer? Why did he stay silent? All of those kinds of things. So we had a period of renewal where we actually went through and we had a focused time of being able to answer these questions that naturally came up as a result of going through this, what we sometimes call our wilderness experience, wandering around in the wilderness, you know, not too sure whether we'd ever get to our destination. So I think it's important to set aside time for that, whether it be reading books or courses or retreats or something like that, sitting down with a mentor, sitting down with a pastor or a priest. So we had that. And then the fourth one was reinvention. There was an opportunity there for us to start again and kind of focus on some of those things, maybe become different people through this experience. And our faith actually had a big important role to play in that, because we believe that God was kind of leading us through into something else. We don't know, by the way, you know, for those Christians that are listening, we still don't know why God said no to us. We haven't got those answers, but we did kind of sense in which there was a new season opening up for us to be different people and to focus on different things and to pursue almost a different mission in life. And that's certainly what has happened. So, yeah, rest, recreation, renewal, and reinvention.
And listening to what he's saying, it's, you know, I think that it also renewed your relationship, too, because I think what so many patients are going through is this struggle for 10 years, 6 years, 5 years, and the toll that it takes on your relationship. And I'm sure if you looked back on that year with all of the ups and downs, you found this new appreciation and this new love for each other after everything you'd been through, too.
Yeah, we did. Now, we were one of those couples that going through the experience was really hard on our marriage, but it did actually make us stronger. So we're really grateful for that. But there were times where we would sit on the couch for 2 or 3 hours at a time, talking things through, praying things through, and still not really coming out on the same page afterwards. But the fact is, we were able to, there was sacrifice on both sides. And I think that's really important, is that sometimes we want marriage or on our own terms, and the sacrifices that both of us made actually meant that our relationship is so much stronger as a result of going through that time. We wouldn't wish it on our worst enemy, but the fact is that our relationship is wonderful as a result of going through that and staying together through it.
Sheridan, what are some of the things that have surprised you about living child-free? And then I'm not asking you to speak for Meryn, but I guess I am asking you to speak for her. And what are some of the things that she's shared with you, if they are different, and they might well be, that have surprised her with your new reinvented life, which is a child-free life?
That's a good question. I'm not too sure that Meryn would say there's been any surprises.
Well, think of it another way. Let's say advantages, things that you had not anticipated enjoying once you gave yourself permission to accept this new life.
Yeah. Well, certainly moving countries is certainly a big thing. If we actually have had children, I don't know if we're the kind of couple that would just have been able to do that as well. Some couples are, of course, and many families move to different countries all the time. I don't know whether we would have been the couple that would have been able to make that work. So being able to do that. Meryn has a pretty amazing job at Oxford University. She has also done some consulting work for the World Health Organization in Geneva. You know, she's doing some pretty amazing things and being able to invest her life in worthy things and invest her skills and her energy and her time in worthy things. Certainly the big surprise, and I think the benefit that has come out of this, is I put it in these terms: we've been initiated into a particular tribe, a tribe of the scarred, if you want to use a phrase. It's a group of people that empathy will only take you so far close to the tribe, but it's only once you've got the scars that you're kind of allowed into the tribe and you're initiated into it, if you know what I mean. And so we have had couples come and share their story in our lounge rooms, in peers, and they'll say that's the first time they've ever shared the story to anybody. We've kind of been part of helping a number of people, and not just infertile couples, but other couples or other individual single people that have had their own broken dream. They haven't been able to get married, and because they haven't been able to get married, they haven't been able to have the family that they so wanted. We've been able to help them on their healing journey, if you like. So that's been part of the transformation for us, is that we've kind of turned into these people that have just been able to come alongside others that are struggling and say, you know what? We know a little bit about what that journey is like. We don't know exactly what it's like for you, but we know a little bit about what it's like. And maybe here are some pointers, here's some way out of the wilderness, a little bit further ahead. And that has actually been a real joy. It really has, to be able to help people and serve people in that kind of way. But the other thing that I will say, Dawn, is the surprise has also been that sometimes I will still have feelings where I will see a really good-looking family, and maybe I'll see a father with his teenage daughter or something. They might have a real close relationship, and there'll be a part of me that'll say, oh, that's not fair, I wanted that, even though I wasn't really that strong in having children in the first place. Sometimes it does actually come up for me. So it happens both ways, but the fact is that we're walking a really exciting path, a really great life, and we don't mourn every single day the fact that we don't have children. We're reminded about it sometimes, but we don't mourn for it anymore. We've been able to move on, and that itself is a gift.
I can absolutely see that. I'd like to take a couple of moments to thank a few more of our gold sponsors and to remind you that it is through their generous support that we can bring you this show and all the resources we have at Creating a Family. We have Cryos International. They are a New York sperm bank, which are part of the world's largest international network of sperm banks. They offer donor semen and semen storage services with the ability to ship specimen to more than 65 countries. And we also have Fairfax Cryobank. Fairfax has been a leader in sperm donation for over 20 years and is dedicated to supplying updated, verified, and accurate medical and personal information on their donors. Sharon, I just want to say again how much I truly enjoyed the book. It is a book that is hopeful for a life well lived after broken dreams. And I do think it is relevant. I mean, in your case, the broken dream was the lack was infertility, not being able to have children. But I think it would be relevant for people of any form of broken dream. And I very much appreciated that you wrestled with God and didn't come up with pat answers, but allowed the ambiguity to remain. It's something of the, like Rabbi Kushner's book, Why Bad Things Happen to Good People, to a certain extent. I mean, it's I very much, and you ended, or you didn't end, but at some point in the book you said, even if your worst fears are realized, it can be okay. And I think that is ultimately the gift. That the gift that I got out of the book was the ultimate thought that, in fact, the worst is not always as terrible as you might imagine, and there can be joy in your future. I want to tell anybody who is listening, our audience, please, if you've enjoyed this show, please consider helping us grow by rating it on podcasts. We are the number one rate on iTunes, rather. We are the number one rated podcast on iTunes in these areas. And we would appreciate very much, in fact, if you would give us a rating. And if you're feeling particularly generous, we would also appreciate a comment. But I'm not pushing my luck. We'll just take a star rating. It's really easy. Just go to our website, click on the iTunes button under on the radio page, and it will take you there. Or if you are have iTunes on your phone or your computer, just go there, type in the words Creating a Family, and you will have the ability to rate us there. Thank you so much, Jen Gamper and Sheridan Vozzi, for being our guest today on Creating a Family. As I said, I'm going to be blogging on the book and the topic tomorrow, and if you're interested in continuing the discussion, please join us. That I would very much appreciate that. If you would like to get more information on Jen Gamper, you can go to she's affiliated with RMA New Jersey, one of our wonderful sponsors, I might add. You can go to their website, which is rmanj.com. I recommend that you do that. I also firmly recommend that you buy the book Resurrection Year. You can, of course, go to Amazon. You could also go to your independent bookseller. We want to support them. You could go and say they may well have the book. If they don't have the book, ask them to order it. That would be something that you could do. I also think you should go to Sheraton's website. The first chapter can be downloaded there for free. He also has some different information there about resurrection years and that concept and making peace with dreams unfulfilled. It's a great website for that reason as well. That website is Sheraton Voisey. I said it wrong, I think, before. Voisey. And I'm going to spell that out, .com. Sheridan, Sheridan, Voisey, Voisey, all run together, SheridanVoisey.com. Thank you so much, both of you, for joining us today. And thank you, audience, for joining us today. I will see you next week.
Hi, it's Jamie, Progressive's Employee of the Month, 2 months in a row. Leave a message at the...
Hi, Jamie. It's me, Jamie. I just had a new idea for our song about the Name Your Price tool. So when it's like, tell us what you want to pay, hey, 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 and the trombone goes, blah, 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 and you say, we'll help you find coverage options to fit your budget. Then we just all do finger snaps while a choir goes, savings coming at ya, savings coming at ya. Yes? No? Maybe? Anyway, see you at practice tonight. I got new lyrics for the rap break.
Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
The Starlight Lounge presents An Evening with the Progressive Box.
Old moon, yeah. That's Hugo tickling the ivories. He just saved by bundling home and auto with Progressive. Gonna finally buy a ring for that gal of yours, Hugo? Send her my condolences. Hi-oh! This next one's for you, too. There's a burglar in my heart. Thank you.
Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Discounts not available in all states or situations.